Welcome to Wildlife Outdoors with your host, Russell and Jose. If you have a passion for conservation of the outdoors, or you're enjoying a calming hike in the mountains, an exhilarating kayak trip on the river, feeling a fish on the end of your line, cooking on an open flame in a primitive campsite, or stalking big game, just waiting for the perfect shot, you're in the right place. So put on your boots and polarized sunglasses and come along for the ride.
What's happening, y'all? Welcome back to the podcast. We got some exciting news coming up for y'all on this episode. There's a lot of adventures that are going to be coming your way that we're going to document and have some podcast episodes on. And then after that, we're going to talk about a little bit of a conservation conversation. So thank y'all again for joining. It's Russell and Jose, and I guess we'll get into it. So Jose, have you ever heard of the company Sherpa before?
Sherpa. I can't say that I have.
Okay, so I believe that's how it's pronounced, at least. It's S-H-R-P-A. that's the only way I can think to pronounce it. So it's, I believe they're called Sherpa, and basically they are a travel company. So the premise of them is they get with tourist departments of places all over the country, and those places will reach out to Sherpa and say, hey, you know, we have this event going on, or we have this time of year that we are trying to get people to come visit. And they'll create a collaboration, and then they'll invite creators, bloggers, vloggers, photographers, stuff like that, to go around to these locations and do a set of activities. So you can either do those collaborations there, or you can kind of do your own thing. And if you do your own thing, you're not going to get paid, per se. But if you do your own thing and post your adventures, then that can draw other parts of the country to say, hey, I like the type of product this person's putting out there. I would like them to come visit here. So in my case, I've done a lot of Arkansas travel. I actually posted our Eagle Nest State Park up in New Mexico. I made that into one of the little posts I put on Sherpa, like, what was that, last year, 2 years ago? So I used it. I did one in Heber Springs area, I believe. And I think I did another one in like Conway, Arkansas area. Well, they reached out to me and they're wanting to do some collaborations with me in Northwest Arkansas. So I got a couple adventures going on up there here. I think one's going to be later on this month and one is going to be later on in September. So those are going to be coming up soon. So one of them is going to be like a family day out. They're going to rent us some boats. We're going to go out on some lakes, take some pictures, eat at some local food shops, and go to some local shops downtown Fayetteville and just kind of hang around, blog what we did, take some pictures, and do that. And the other one, I believe, is called All About Water. So it's also kind of in the same, you know, territory, but this one's going to involve a little bit more fishing and kayaking and finding waterfalls and stuff like that. So I think that one, me and Ruth are just gonna go up, kayak, maybe do some fishing, and hit all those. That one though is gonna be a little more extensive. I think that they want me to hit 10 different locations within a 6-town area around the Fayetteville area. So I think it's gonna be pretty fun, and the best part is I get paid a little bit to do it, and they'll cover lodging and whatnot.
Dude, that's a pretty sweet little gig you got.
Right? I'm pretty excited about it. So got those coming up, and hopefully I'll be getting more. They asked me to set my boundaries on what areas I want to go to, and I just put the whole U.S., including Hawaii and Alaska.
Nice. So how does that work? Is there like a, I guess like a quota that you have to like to hit or something like that for, you know, places to go or places to kind of, I guess, like talk about or show, you know?
So first they want you to do, it's either 3 or 4. I think it's 3. You have to do 3 posts, and each post has to have at least 3 locations in each post. So if someone were to go to Central Texas, for instance, they could do something on the San Marcos River. They could do a local restaurant, Garcia's, since we've talked about them, and then maybe a kayak and canoe shop or a fly shop or something like that. So if they had those 3 different spots, they would take pictures, write a short blog on them, and then from there they put those all into one post and then they post it. and it has to have pictures. And I think, so yeah, it's like a three sentence minimum. You got to have pictures and all that. And so that's all one post, and you have to do three of those posts before you're able to even qualify for a paid collaboration. And then the paid collaboration is on like a scale. So the more collaborations that you do, the more you get paid, up to, I think, 8 collaborations. Once you get to 8 paid collaborations, then the standard payout that you get is the same from there on out. But they all vary. Like, for instance, the one that we're doing with the boats, they're going to offer us lodging and they're going to rent the boats for us. Some of them, the community will actually provide lodging. So for one of them in Fayetteville, they're providing lodging. For the other one, Sherpa is actually going to provide lodging. So they can provide lodging. Some of them are just day trips or half day trips. If that's the case, they're typically not going to provide lodging. But if it's something where they want you to hit 6 to 10 locations and it's going to be a whole day or two adventure, then they're going to provide lodging for you most likely.
Interesting. So those three posts, is there a certain time frame you have to like get those up? Is it for the year or like a month?
So some of them have like a month time frame. So you have to schedule, and you actually have to schedule it with them. So when you apply for the collaboration, you say, okay, well, this weekend works for me. And since it's getting closer to college football time, they asked me on the second one to avoid Razorback home games because it's harder for them to find lodging and stuff like that. So typically, whenever you apply, you're going to put what dates that you would prefer to go, and they'll tell you if that's available or if that's not available or whatever the case may be. So they'll say, okay, one of them, I believe, was listed from any time between July 31st and September 1st or something like that, or September 31st. And then the other one was from, I think, August 1st to September 31st. So it's like a month or two in between for some of them. And it's any time within that time frame that you can apply for.
Interesting. That's pretty
cool. Yes, sir. And
that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then on top of that, they have like on Instagram and stuff. So it's not like, you know, if you do like stock photos, you're doing like Shutterstock mm-hmm. or any of those type of things, you pretty much have to sign over the rights to your pictures and say, okay, well, if I put this picture on Shutterstock or any of those other stock companies, that you can't use it for your own profit, your own benefit, your own socials or anything like that. So this isn't like that. They encourage you to post it on your account, but tag them in it. And so it gives them the right to use it. And they'll reach out to you and say, hey, you know, you mind if we use your Instagram picture for this? But if you're posting the similar pictures or same pictures that you're posting on Sherpa, then they'll just use your post instead of having to go to your socials and take it from there. So for one of the ones in Conway, Arkansas, mine is actually the featured post for that. So if somebody's going to go to the region, it shows mine. Remember when I was talking to you before about the long exposure I took of the waterfall, the little creek waterfall?
Yes.
I actually used that picture in that post, and that's the featured picture for it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So it's just stuff like that to where they get rights to use your stuff, but you can still use it for your own stuff. So you tag them in it. But also, if you're not a Sherpa creator and you just want to look for an interesting place to go or look for family things, you can go to their Instagram and go through their post and see, oh, well, that looks pretty cool. Where's that at? And it'll give you ideas on where you want to travel, if you want to take a vacation somewhere or anything like that as well.
Dude, that's pretty freaking awesome, man.
It is. It is. I'm excited. I'm hoping that I can go on a lot more, broad vacations instead of just, you know, a couple hours away, North Arkansas, stuff like that.
If they reached out to you and they said, hey, Russell, we'll cover your travel and all that stuff, you know, wherever you want to go, anywhere in the U.S., is there a particular place you'd like to go, or somewhere that's like on the top, or is there like something at the top of your list that you'd like to go to, or something you'd like to do?
I think Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, any of those, or Hawaii. I mean, I've always wanted to go to Hawaii. I've never had the opportunity. I don't even know if they have any Sherpa locations over there, but yeah, I would say Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, that part of the country is a place that I would love to go.
Idaho is not really like, I mean, I would imagine at least the people whom I've talked to, many of them never, if at all, mention Idaho. Is there a particular reason like you want to? I mean, I know I'd like to go, but is there a reason why you'd want to go to Idaho? in particular?
So Idaho's like, it's like a hidden gem, man. Like, it's everybody, all the outdoorsmen. Oh, I'm going to go to Montana. Oh, I'm going to go to Wyoming. Idaho's like the same kind of terrain, same types of rivers, same types of creeks. You can go blue lining out there. There's larger bodies of water. You can chase bull trout. You can find species that it's hard to find anywhere else. They actually have pike in certain parts of Idaho. There's just a bunch of outdoorsman stuff to do, but it's not as populated nor as expensive as Montana or Wyoming. So in my opinion, it's kind of like a hidden gem.
I agree. Shout out to our fellow Idahoans. I don't even know.
Idahoans?
I don't know. We apologize if we butchered that, but I have no idea.
Well, anybody, if we have any listeners or if anybody knows that's a local, are you Idahoans, Idahoians? Go ahead and let us know what to call y'all.
Or something completely different.
Right. Oh, they're going to come out with something like, what?
Yeah, we're so dumb, dude. Geography.
Hey, we're just inexperienced.
Geography is not my strong suit, let me tell you.
No, mine either. But yeah, that's where I would want to go. So if you had to go anywhere in the country, where would you go?
Anywhere in the country. Honestly, Idaho would be pretty up there. Okay, does it have to be like the continental U.S. or can like provinces count?
It doesn't have to be continental.
But can provinces and things count, like Puerto Rico?
Yes. Ooh, yes.
Okay. I think if I had to choose, it would either be, I think the top three, I can't really narrow it down, the top three in no particular order would probably be Idaho, Alaska, and Puerto Rico, I think.
I agree with that. I agree with that.
I think those would be my top three.
So Puerto Rico is one that I've always wanted to go to. I don't know what it is. Gorgeous waters. I've heard friendly people, good food. I love ethnic food. But doesn't Puerto Rico have some really good fishing? Tarpon, bonefish, permit.
Yeah. So to be fair, I don't know much about Puerto Rico. I only know, what I know basically because of my friend and roommate who is from there. And when he actually picked up fly fishing during the pandemic, and he and I would go fishing. So he'd gone fishing before in Puerto Rico from what he's told me, but he never really, I guess, got into it as much as he is now. So like since he's been back after having picked up fly fishing, it's almost as if, and these aren't his words, this is just my, just my perception of just from what we've gathered in conversation and stuff. But I think he kind of sees Puerto Rico and the fishery from a new perspective of having picked up fly fishing and stuff like that. Cause he's gone fly fishing before. Well, he went fly fishing in Puerto Rico not too long ago. And, dude, he caught some really nice tilapia. He's caught, I think it was I can't remember what kind of cichlid, it was a Mayan or something like that. He's caught all kinds of, or Midas. I can't remember. But he caught all kinds of stuff. And so what's pretty cool is obviously Puerto Rico's an island, so there's a bunch of salt water around. And he said, like, there are times where you can find some really nice tarpon, snook, like, everywhere, bonefish, obviously, and some portions of the island, not everywhere, but he knows where to go for those. He's seen them before. And then also in the mountains of Puerto Rico, there's, like, freshwater streams that hold some pretty awesome freshwater fish. So he gets really excited when he's talking about it. And it gets me excited because he's like, dude, Puerto Rico is like an untouched gem. Like not a whole lot of people, at least for fly fishing, not a whole lot of people really know about it, I guess. Cause he doesn't like when he goes, like since he's been back, he doesn't really see anybody fly fishing. Growing up, he said he's never really seen anybody fly fishing, at least where he's from or where he's been. So there's potential that Puerto Rico is a pretty dope little fishery, man. From what he says, like the tarpon don't get as big as other places like Costa Rica and stuff, but you can definitely catch some like really solid ones. Snook as well. Actually, he says that there's some pretty big snook. And when he went last, he said, I think he lost a really nice barracuda or something. Like there's, I mean, it's a pretty dope little fishery from what he's told me. And he's all, and then in like in that conversation, the same conversation, he's like, yeah, man, anytime you want to go, let me know. We can plan a trip. you know, all that stuff. So, and since he's got family there, he's like, you don't even have to worry about like finding a place to stay. You can stay with me and family, whatever. You just got to pay for like gas and food and stuff to get around the island. But he's like, it's pretty cheap, at least the food, and really good. So I was like, hell yeah, man. Like I'm down. So we've talked about going, we just haven't actually put into action a plan to go.
Man, we got to do that. I'd love to go to Puerto Rico. And I just looked at our statistics and we actually have some listeners in Puerto Rico. So shout out, guys.
Dude, really?
Yeah, we do. We have 1% of our listeners are from Puerto Rico. They're just above Spain.
Sweet.
So, yeah, pretty interesting. But yeah, man, I think we should definitely try to plan that out. You know, I love me some food.
That is true. That is true. Dude, good food, good fishing. I mean, I'm down, bro. I'm down. We'll try and get, maybe we can even have him on a podcast and talk about it too himself. And
yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think that'd be really cool, man. And we should start planning it, bro, because I am down. I need to get out of College Station for a little bit. Right. I need some.
Dude, you know where else I would want to go?
What is that?
I was talking to one of my buddies recently. I don't know if you've ever met my buddy Brad from up here. He used to live upstairs in the apartments that I live at.
No, never met him.
So he's from the Bahamas originally. And so I talked about a couple episodes ago how me and Ruth went kayaking with one of my friends and his wife. That's who it is.
Yes.
My buddy Brad Nairn. Shout out to Brad. So he's from the Bahamas originally. And I was talking to him about, you know, what they got over there. Mm-hmm. And he says that he grew up fishing and stuff like that. Obviously not fly fishing, but he was regular fishing. He says they catch a lot of barracuda out there. And I looked it up and I don't remember what other species are common over there. But dude, just the waters over there are freaking insanely clear. And just going over there and could you imagine sight fishing a 6-foot barracuda on the fly?
I think I'd be too nervous to get a cast off.
Like, well, that's how I felt with that first redfish I cooked, hooked.
Before the big redfish you cooked?
Yeah, that one too.
So
cooked it, hooked it, same thing.
Is there a term for, like, you know how when you go hunting and you see a buck, you get buck fever or whatever? Is there a term, like a fishing term for that same like experience? I don't know.
I haven't heard one, but we need to coin one.
We should. I don't know.
I don't even know. But yeah, dude, it was crazy. Like when I casted at that first big redfish, I fell off the casting platform. I dropped my rod in the water. The line was wrapped around the rail. Like I couldn't clear the line to get to the rail. It was horrible. And so I'm pretty sure I would do the exact same thing again.
Dude, yeah, when I was talking to your buddy, the one you went fishing with, he was like, oh, dude, you should have seen Russell. He was like shaking. He like all nervous. He couldn't even cast.
Yeah, dude, it's but crazy. Because I've never seen him like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame you. I've never seen, I mean, the biggest redfish that I've seen in the flat. Well, to be fair, I've actually seen maybe... So it was well over 30 inches, maybe pushing 40, but that thing was like, it was on a mission, man. He wouldn't give us a time of day. I was with some friends and we were casting like whatever we had in our line at the time and it just did not care. It was just like cruising. That was and even that, man, like I was shaking. So I can only imagine how you felt.
Right. Dude, so the one that I casted at and originally hooked that I lost was well over 50. It was a monster. Freaking huge.
So
do you
ever think about that fish?
I do. I mean, it was a couple hours later that I caught the one that I had the picture of me holding, which is a massive fish, but the one before that was bigger. And I just think about it, it's like, because so when I was out there this a couple weekends ago, whenever it was that I was down there on Port Aransas, and I come across that school of jacks. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as nervous as I was when I first went down, when I was down there in Venice. So I don't know if I would be that nervous again, but that was my first time like just seeing a fish that I could cast to that is that massive. And then it ate and I set the hook and I had no clue what to do. Cause I've also never hooked a fish that takes off like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was immediate, you know, the guide, shout out to Cleve Evans. He was like, all right, she ate, set the hook. And right when I set the hook, it was just gone. I didn't have time to clear the line. Line immediately wrapped around the reel. I was trying to fix that, have my line at my feet. I mean, it was just, it was all so fast, and I'd never done it before, and I was nervous. So on top of shaking, barely making a cast, being able to set the hook, and then just not even knowing how to clear the line, and I mean, it was just a lot. So I think it was everything piled up, but I was extremely, I mean, I was physically shaking. So it was so bad that I couldn't stand on the casting platform. I went ahead and got off and told Brian he can get up there because I couldn't even keep my bearings. So it was, yeah, it was intense, but.
Like camping?
Yeah, exactly. Just like camping. So it was, oh, dad jokes. Gotta love it. But yeah, it was intense for sure. But I think I'd probably be a little more calm if it were to happen again. But then again, a Barracuda is a whole nother thing. They're toothy. They're faster. They're stronger. Bigger. So I just might be as nervous again.
Dude, oddly enough, the only fish I've at least to date that I've had like take off on me like that has been a carp. Like I've hooked some redfish now, and it's kind of weird, man. Like they, at least the ones that I've hooked, they're just kind of like, when I set the hook, they just kind of give a head shake, like almost like, mm-hmm. like they can tell that something, you know, stuck them in the lip or whatever, but they just don't care. They just kind of swim along. And then I guess when they finally feel the tension, they're like, oh damn, I'm like something stuck to me, and they just take off. But it's like a really slow reaction, man. They've never just like, I've never set into one and just have them like explode like that. But
right,
that's crazy.
And that's how this was. And it was, I mean, cause you're right. Like a redfish kind of reminds me of like Eeyore. They're just kind of big, brutish, like lackadaisical, lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, this one and the other one that I actually landed took off, and they dig too. So when we were out there, they just straight dig to the bottom, and then they like to go into the boats. The one that I actually fought for a good while and landed, I can't name how many times it went straight down under the boat. And I thought that freaking mangrove coast was going to snap because it was doubled over, and I'm trying to, you know, not horse on it, but like leave a little bit enough tension so it doesn't get off. I mean, it was just, mm-hmm. it was stressful. But you know what kind of fish takes off that, I don't know if you've ever caught one. Have you ever caught a red horse sucker?
Yes.
Did it take off on you?
Yeah, actually, it was pretty exciting. Like, I was really surprised at how well they fought.
So the first red horse sucker I caught was maybe a foot long, and I hooked it on, I want to say the 6-weight sage, mm-hmm. and it was peel and drag. And I was just like, holy crap. And then not too long after that, probably about 15, 20 minutes later, I'd caught a few in between. I hooked into one that was the size of my forearm, this massive freaking red horse. And it took off and it peel drag upstream in this creek. And I mean, it took me a good 5 minutes, and I hooked it 3 feet from where I was at.
That's
and
wild.
It took me 5 minutes to bring it in. I mean, it was peel and drag and it was taking off. Those fish go.
Dude, carp in the same way. Like the first carp I ever hooked, it was actually in a pond. I didn't know it was a carp. I think I told this story already, but I didn't know it was a carp. I thought it was just like some bluegill feeding, because I could just hear like the sucking and whatever, and like the little pieces of bread that people were throwing in, like disappearing. So I went over there with a lano bug trying to hook this, you know, little bluegill, whatever. And when I cast it, I just saw big rubber lips come up and suck down a piece of bread that was right next to my fly. I was like, oh my God. So I cast it back over there. I don't know why. I had a 3-weight, like it's stupid, but I just did. And then that time, like the, you know, the lips came up, sucked down another piece of bread. And then just as I was about to lift my rod, they came back and just swallowed that lano bug. And when I set the hook, dude, that thing freaking, like, it just exploded. And it actually jumped out of the water. I didn't know carp could be so acrobatic, but it just jumped out of the water. And probably, I don't even know, man, flew like 4-6 feet in the air, just like a golden rocket going through the air. It was freaking nuts. And it was just like, it all happened so fast, dude. Like if I would have had that line, not clear the reel or anything like that, it would have been bad. Actually, the last redfish I hooked, when I hooked it, kind of like I described to you earlier, it just shook its head and kind of kept swimming like nothing, like, it was like all good. And then when it felt me still, like, I guess putting pressure, that's when it took off. And I was on the kayak, and the line did actually get wrapped around my reel. But I think because I was on the kayak and it could more or less like tow me, it didn't have enough pressure from taking off to break my line. So I was able to get the reel the line undone from my reel and have it go. And it was just like rip and drag, but I should have probably lost that fish, but I did somehow. And it was like a 24, 25 inch red, nothing like you caught, but it was still, a heck of a fight on the 8-weight, but it was, yeah, man, that was freaking nuts.
Dude, I've always wanted to catch a fish big enough on the kayak to tow me around.
I mean, it don't take much, dude. This little dude was towing me around. Like, it's pretty crazy. But I mean, a fish like what you have is like riding a bull. it's just going to go.
Could you imagine be standing there like fish bank fishing in the flats or something and just see this random guy come flying by holding onto a rod, fish towing him through the flats on his kayak?
Dude, that would
be hilarious to watch.
Speaking of that, did you see the video that I sent you on Instagram?
Which one?
There was an offshore boat. They were going and they see this dude in one of those unicorn floaties. And they're like, what the hell? They're like in the middle of nowhere. And I don't know if that guy, to be fair, I don't know if the dude on the floaty was part of the crew or not. They just kind of set it up to look that way. But the way they made it seem in the video, this dude was in this unicorn floaty and he had a rod in his hand. They're like, what are you doing? He goes, I got a fish on. I got a shark on, whatever. He's like fishing. And then so they go up to him. And they help him out, and then the guy gets on the boat. He goes, "Don't forget the unicorn." So they're trying to get the unicorn up, and he's like, "Dude, do you have a fighting belt?" So they had to go and find a fighting belt, and they started finding this shark, and it turned out to be like a 10-foot shark. Apparently, the dude hooked it.
No shit.
Yeah, apparently, I guess the dude was just chilling on the beach and was fishing, and it hooked it on the beach, and I guess the shark towed him offshore, and he was found by a boat, dude. And I was like, "What the hell, man?" I don't know how true that is, but if it is true, that dude could have been in some serious trouble.
Right, dude. Even if it was set up, I couldn't even imagine being pulled 5 feet by a shark while on a little floaty like that. I'd be freaking scared,
bro. Screw that, ain't happening, man.
That's freaking crazy. That's hilarious, though,
dude. If I was on the beach, bro, and I'm getting pulled out by something, I'm not gonna lie, I'm busting my line. If I ain't got a knife to do it, I'm just opening my spool, letting it go and spool me. I'm not taking a chance.
Right. Yeah. You gotta be safe. Can't be doing stupid stuff out there.
I mean,
dude, so have you listened to the shark fishing episode by Cut and Retie?
I think so. Dude, isn't that podcast great?
Dude, it's awesome.
Dude, Joe Cirelli is a podcast. It's one of my favorites right now, man. Joe Cirelli is a fantastic storyteller, I guess, because he's also a writer. So he's just really good at like painting and setting up story. I mean, it's a fantastic podcast. Well, I don't personally know him or anything, but if anybody's listening to this who hasn't heard it, I highly recommend it. He doesn't really like it's just fishing. It doesn't matter if it's fly fishing or whatever. It's just based on fishing. So if you like fishing, whether it's fly fishing, whatever, I think you would dig this dude's podcast. It's freaking fantastic. But anyway, sorry, Russell. Yeah, go ahead.
It is. So yeah, it was just the episode on shark fishing that I was talking about, where they were having a pretty stagnant day, no wind, water wasn't really moving, and they ended up hooking that shark right before they left.
Was it a mako?
Yes.
Yes, I did hear that.
That was his one chance to actually harvest a mako before they made it to where you can't harvest makos.
Yeah. Well, on the East Coast, apparently on the West Coast, I think you still can't, or something like that. At least that's what they said in the podcast. Something like that.
Yeah, that is what they said. They're saying somebody from California reach out to Joe, take him out there. But yeah, I mean, it's, to me, it was kind of reminiscent of your carp story.
Yeah.
With you losing the carp due to somebody else doing something.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of what I took from that. But although it was his fault for not having the gaff set up properly,
that is true too.
But his buddy went to set the gaff, the head came off, and yeah, all of that. If y'all haven't listened to it, I'd highly recommend going to listen to Cut and Retie, specifically the shark episodes. You can actually hear the way that they tell it. I'm not even going to try to butcher it, but it's a pretty funny story on a mako excursion for them.
Dude, it is. And that, I'm not gonna lie, man, that's why I have now, anyway, I get really nervous when people try to net a fish for me.
yep.
I'd rather do it myself, so that way if I screw up, then I'm the one to blame, you know. And
exactly.
And but I mean, to be fair, that to that person who they tried to help, it was just, I guess, like their inexperience, you know.
Yeah.
But it's whatever. It's a carp pond anyway. Or sorry, it's a pond carp anyway. Like, not that there's anything wrong with that. Just personally, I would really like my first carp to be from like being able to sight cast it in a river, in the wild, whatever, and go from there. So I was really bummed about it, but I've, and it's still, to be fair, still does kind of haunt me. But at the same time, I'm kind of glad in a weird way that it worked out the way it did. And if anything, right, it's because of that fish that I have become so obsessed with these fish and have grown to really appreciate them. So a lot can be said. A lot of good, I think, came from that experience, regardless of how I felt about it in the moment.
Yeah, which in turn led you to land your first carp in a bayou side casting. So
grass carp.
Yes, grass carp. It was a carp, though.
It was a
carp. But I didn't realize until after we ended the podcast talking about that I didn't talk about my little trip to Houston.
No, you did not. That's right.
I did not. And that is a tough fishery. My goodness, is that a tough fishery for what it is.
But it's also, you came at a not ideal time because it's so freaking hot.
True. It was over 100 degrees. Kids were out there sweating their butts off, and I just felt bad. I stayed 30 minutes and said, okay, I got to call it. I did see some fish. I casted at some fish. There were some mullet in there that were schooled up. And I mean, if I walked within 50 feet of them, I mean, they were scramming. They were just, I don't even know what I would even try to cast at a mullet, but when the carp weren't ready to play, I was like, oh, let me try to cast some with them. So I threw some little bitty like midges and gnats on. Mullet didn't want nothing to do with them. And the carp were there. There were some other fish that I seen, and I don't know if they were mullet, but there were some other fish schooled up on the other side. And I casted at them, and I was making some pretty decent casts, and the drift was right, but they weren't interested either. And I threw, I think probably 5 or 6 different carp patterns at the carp, with no luck. So, for a 30-minute little trip stop over there in Houston, no luck, but I definitely need to make a trip back to that area, and we need to go fish it heavy.
Let's do it, man. I want to go back. I was there probably for, in the same spot, mind you, I was there for like a good 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And it took me maybe within the last 15, 20 minutes that I was there to actually hook the carp. I did hook another fish before it got off. But it's a tough fishery because at least where we were and where I showed you, it's like you're pretty up high. So you have to look into the water. So they're more than likely they can see you. But also at this time of year, that sun is just radiating off that concrete. So you're getting hit from on top. You're getting hit from below. It freaking sucks, dude. There's like not any trees nearby. So you can't really like go and chill in the shade. It's not fun. If I were to go and do it all over again, I'd probably go early in the morning and then fish till, I don't even know, 11, maybe mid-noon before, you know, before it gets too miserable, and then book it. Because it's freaking brutal, man. It sucks.
Yeah. I got there kind of early. I got there around 10, 11 o'clock. But by that point, it was already triple digits. I mean, it was just hot. And then the area that I was at, it was a very busy day for bicyclists and rollerbladers. So, it was just trying to time it between people coming. And there was a couple times where I was already in my back cast and someone comes riding by and I'm like, and I just like stop and hold my rod up and let my fly line fall to the ground behind me. And it was a tough fishing day, but it wasn't horrible. Definitely need to make a trip back.
Yeah. See, it's kind of funny because I call fishing around here in College Station urban fishing, but Houston urban fishing, now that is a whole different ballgame. Yeah. Dude, it's insane. It's fun. It's like it presents its own set of challenges, which is really neat, really fun, but also very frustrating as you experienced firsthand. But yeah, dude, we should definitely plan a trip, go back and try and stick some carp.
For sure, for sure.
And the mullet, that reminds me of the, did I ever tell you about my mullet story on the coast?
I don't think so.
the first saltwater. Okay, let me rephrase. I've caught speckled trout off the pier with a fly rod. Those are like my first saltwater fish. My first saltwater fish in the flats off a kayak was a freaking mullet. Me and my buddy Marco, who was on in a previous episode, a few episodes back, he and I went down to the coast and we were fishing this area. And I just saw some nervous water, so I started making some casts with a redfish crack, a blue crab colored redfish crack. And I'm just stripping it in, and then I feel like a little nibble, and I kept stripping it in, and then I felt a solid take, so I strip set, and it was actually pulling pretty decent. I thought it was like an undersized redfish or a ladyfish, and I got it towards me, and it's a freaking mullet, dude. And it had the redfish crack like in its like gullet, like it had straight up eaten the redfish crack. I thought I foul hooked
really?
It, but it actually ate the redfish crack. Freaking nuts, man. Actually, I took a picture of it. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, what the hell? I have never hooked a mullet before, crazy. Ever. And it ate a redfish crack.
That's insane.
That's pretty awesome.
I've caught some interesting fish on a redfish crack. Didn't you tie me up some with some, I think you had some dubbing brushes with tarantula legs in them, and they were like blue and orange.
Yes. Yeah, I think I did try you some.
So if I'm not mistaken, I caught my first smallmouth on that redfish crack.
You told me about that. Yeah.
Like, and then I've caught brim on that redfish crack. I've caught, green sunfish and I think it was a long ear on that redfish crack. I've caught spotted bass, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, but I've yet to catch saltwater species on a redfish crack.
Dude, I'm honestly convinced, especially when it comes to bass, with certain exceptions, but I'm honestly convinced as long as it looks like it's something they could eat, they're going to try and eat it. Like, I really don't think they're as picky. Not to say that they can't be picky. They very well can, especially like in really clear and pressured waters. They definitely can. But I would say like in general, I don't think they're as picky as people make them out to be. Like, that's why I guess when I tie flies and stuff, don't get me wrong, like it feels good when you turn out a really pretty fly, and when you're buying custom flies or something, if you're spending your own hard earned money, of course you want the fly to look good. But if I turn out one that's like not that great, whatever, I don't really get that upset about it. Flies will end up getting destroyed. They'll start losing feathers or hair, whatever. They're going to get ratty looking, but they'll still catch fish. So I'm not totally upset. At least when I'm filling my own fly box, if I'm like putting in some not so nice looking flies, but if I'm tying for other people or if someone wants to buy some for me, then I'll take a bit more care into the final product, just because I don't want them to receive like a mediocre product, if that makes any sense. But
exactly.
I really don't.
Yeah, when I'm tying for myself, they're typically guide flies.
Yeah. Guide flies are the best flies.
They are. Pop them out quick. Fill your box with them. You know you're going to lose them anyways, especially when you're fishing rivers like I do. I don't. It never fails. I'm getting something hung up underwater. I'm getting something hung up in an overhang, a branch, a tree, whatever the case. And on moving water, I am not paddling my kayak upstream to free a fly.
I used to get so mad whenever I would lose a fly, but after a while, it's just part of the game, man. You got to pay your taxes. So it is what it is.
It is. I remember I used to go out fishing on the Washita River with this nice game changer. And I'm like, no, game changers are not for moving water like that. If you get hung up one time, next thing you know, you're paddling upstream for 5 minutes to try to get it.
Yeah.
It's, nope. Nope. Not for me. Not for this guy.
Yeah. Especially if you like what's his name? Fish Chase Flies. It's his Instagram handle on Instagram. But I don't remember. I think it's Chase Smith or something like that. That guy can tie some. Sorry if I got your name wrong. But you tie some sick flies, and dude, his freaking game changers are amazing, and they're pricey, rightfully so, dude. Like they look immaculate. They're gorgeous. If I had something like that, oh man, I would probably try and jump in the water and get it back if I could. Because a fly that pretty, a fly that costs that much, I would not feel good losing that. I probably wouldn't even fish it unless like I'm in an area where I know or have a good feeling that it won't get lost as easily.
Right. that's an open water or a pond type of play. You know, if you get hung up on something, you're going swimming for it.
Or like a special occasion thing. Like if I'm fishing for like big striper or something, then I'll throw it there. But like if I'm fishing for pike or something that can potentially cut my line, nah.
Yep.
Not happening.
Did you see his little short video that he made on Texas, like about Texas flats?
Not yet.
Dude, you should check it out. If I'm not mistaken, I think I posted it to our Wildlife Outdoors story today. It's pretty cool. It's some good quality stuff. I don't know. Lately, I've been really liking cinematic shorts.
Yeah.
He puts out some good stuff, good flies, good content. Y'all should go check him out. It's Fish Chase Flies, all one word, on Instagram. And his name is Chase Smith. So some pretty cool stuff going on out there. What is the conservation conversation about today?
Okay, yes. So the conservation conversation. Let me ask you this, though. Have you ever heard of virtual fencing?
Yes.
Okay.
In terms of like for livestock?
Yes. So this was a... this was something that an idea that I had not really heard of or done much research into. But over the last couple months, I've started hearing more and more about it. And it just so happens when I was looking at some stories to talk about for today that there was an article written back in, July 19th, 2023, about virtual fencing. So if there are some of you who may not have heard about it, it's essentially exactly as the name implies. It's a way to fence, but without the actual fence. So virtually. So they essentially attach these GPS collars to livestock, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever. And it works almost in the same way as an invisible dog fence. So you can kind of pre-program like a certain distance where the collar will start beeping. And then if it gets too close, it'll send a shock, kind of like an electric fence. Some people, I think some of the researchers said it's even less powerful than a traditional electrical fence, but it'll do it until it turns the animal, the species in question around to keep it in a certain defined point. And I just thought this was really cool. And this article made some awesome points. So one of the cool things about virtual fencing, obviously, is that you don't have to deal with the fencing. So you don't have to worry about setting up fences. You don't have to worry about maintaining fences. So it's a money saver in that sense. But also, because there are no fences, wildlife are free to move through the landscape. So it doesn't inhibit their movement. So during migrations, like the caribou and stuff like that, or other animals that migrate as well, they can get through relatively easily. And, without much exertion of energy, if you will. And also, sometimes they do get hung up on fences, which is unfortunate, but it happens. And this will mitigate that, or help to mitigate that. And then there are certain species like pronghorn, for example, who aren't really known for jumping fences. They actually prefer to crawl underneath, and doing so will allow them to do so unimpeded. And if there's no fence, they don't have to worry about that. They can just go. And so this is really nice because they can easily move. So if they're running out of forage, whatever, in one spot, they can move elsewhere. And so it should, in theory, help with populations, things like that. And then also fences have been known to hurt bird populations. Like birds will fly into the fences, get caught up and die, stuff like that. So a lack of fences can reduce that. Not only that, but like, for example, rotational grazing. You can have these defined polygons, if you will, of the landscape, and you can have your cattle out there or whatever. And when they finish grazing, you can move them to the next one. So you can give yourself give your land adequate time to rest and build up vegetation again. Also, there's an instance where there was like an invasive grass, and they were able to concentrate all their livestock in there and like eat it down to the ground, essentially, to try and reduce the spread and reduce the prevalence of the invasive grass. And then it can help with, in the case of like fuel load for fires, you can put your livestock out, hold them in certain spots, and they can eat down the vegetation, so it can reduce the spread of fires if there was one, and things like that. So there's a lot of that can also be done with fences for sure. But what's nice about the virtual fencing is you can change the dimensions of the area. So if you want them to be like in a smaller area, you can do that. If you want them to have more room, you can do that, all at the touch of your fingertip, really. So it's really, really cool, really, really efficient. And that's something you can't do with fences. Like, you can't just uproot it and then move it and then set it down again. Like, it doesn't quite work that way. So there's a lot of really cool things, especially like in the West where, you know, there are fences that transect both public and private lands that has caused some issues and things like that. This can help mitigate that. But this is all assuming that, let's just say, for example, everybody switched over to virtual fencing. There are already existing fences. So it is going to take time. It is going to take money to remove those. So it may not be very feasible for fences that are already standing, structures that are already there. However, if like your fence burns down in a fire or something like that, this could be a viable option for your livestock. And also, what's nice is like the GPS data can go right to your phone. So at any given time, you can see exactly where your livestock are. So if one happened, like if the beeping and the shock isn't enough to deter your livestock back to the defined perimeter, you can go and find it and bring it back yourself. So it's a really good way. Or like if maybe a GPS is like staying still for too, like a point staying still for too long, maybe you can go out there and see what's going on. If your, you know, livestock died or whatever the case may be, or if it's sick, you can find these animals relatively easily and attend to them. So there's a lot of benefits that come with virtual fencing, and something that I think is pretty neat and something that we've talked about in academia for a bit, depending on what the study is. And I think it's a pretty cool concept. I don't know of many people who have implemented that, if any. I'm sure there is. Like, I mean, the article states there's one, but at least here in Texas, I don't know if there's any currently using this kind of technology, but
there are.
Yeah. So I thought it was a pretty freaking cool concept, man. Yeah. So in terms of conservation and its effect in conservation, so with assuming that the fences are removed or whatever, or if they've been burnt up or something like that, using this virtual fencing methodology, you can essentially create a more open landscape for wildlife to freely move through unimpeded and kind of get back to more of their historical like migration patterns and things like that, expand their home ranges and all that good stuff. So there is some conservation type of benefits to it as well. It's just something that I just kind of stumbled upon randomly, and it's something that I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah. So I didn't know anything about that until recently. So you remember when I told you that the guy we went to school with, that you actually went to school with in Kingsville also, Hunter Lehman?
Yes.
So his company, Lehman Land and Cattle, is they operate on a ranch in South Texas, and they use virtual fencing. And in that podcast of Grazing Grass that he was a guest on, they talked a lot about the ins and outs of it and stuff like that. And it was crazy to think of how the virtual fencing works. And he went into details as in if you lose internet at the ranch, because a lot of that is out there is not high speed internet and stuff like that. If you lose internet, it'll still, the callers have the data in them on what the fencing is and the GPS coordinates are that they can't go past and stuff like that. And then of course he talks about rotational grazing and stuff. So yeah, it's a pretty interesting concept that I knew nothing about until I listened to that podcast. So if y'all haven't, if that's something you're interested in, go check out Grazing Grass podcast, specifically the episode with Lehman Land and Cattle.
Yeah, because this, what I just talked, is like extremely surface level. Like, this is something I literally just read up on. I mean, I've heard of it, but this article that I found is something I just read up on prior to us recording for this podcast. So definitely check them out. I'm sure their information that they provide will be much more useful and much more detailed than what I've discussed here. But I just thought it was a really neat concept, something that I think has a lot of really cool uses in the future if we try to move more that way. But yeah, man, I just thought it was pretty neat.
It is. It's pretty cool. And in that podcast episode, they go a little bit more into how that affects wildlife and stuff as well. So if that's something that y'all are interested in, definitely go check it out. And it gets a little more into the wildlife side of it and explains how it affects and the benefits of it. So some pretty cool stuff. It's crazy that you come across an article like that I actually know something about. Surprisingly.
I mean, I got that. If anybody wants to read, I got it from mangabay.com. It's a, I guess it's a conservation news website. And so I found it there. But yeah, anyways, I thought it was just pretty cool. Like I said, I'm by no means an expert, so please go check out that podcast or read the article if you'd like some more information. Just wanted to throw that out there and share that with everybody.
Yep, some good conservation conversation there for you. So, in other news, we have a website coming. So, we will officially be on the interwebs with a full-blown website in the coming weeks. So, y'all keep an eye out for that. It is going to be mywildlifeoutdoors.com.
We're growing up, man.
Right, we're finally growing up. And once that goes, we will have a tab on there. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't got ins and outs of the design of the website yet, but there will be a link to our shop. So we will actually have merch launching around the same time.
Yep. Russell and I have been discussing merch options and designs and things like that. So hopefully we'll be bringing that to you guys in the near future. But some exciting stuff happening, especially considering, to be quite honest, I didn't know if we'd ever get to this point, Russell, as a podcast. But it's really exciting to see things kind of, you know, getting bigger, moving up. It's pretty cool.
Yep. It's awesome. It's awesome. I'm excited about it. It's something to where, you know, we're entering new waters here, stuff that neither one of us ever thought we would reach for one, or things that neither of us have experience doing. So it's all new waters and we're going to try to figure our ways through them. But yeah, y'all keep an eye out. We do have a YouTube now as well. So if y'all haven't looked at that, it is Wildlife Outdoors on YouTube. There is one video. I did make a video on the kayak camping trip that I did. The only way that I've been able to find it by searching is typing Wildlife Outdoors Island, and it should be the first one. And it is, I think the title is something kayak camping on an island or something like that. But yeah, y'all should go check that out. That is my first attempt at making a adventure YouTube video, but we do have a YouTube video out on Wildlife Outdoors YouTube channel. So y'all check that out as well.
Yeah, Russell sent me the link earlier. It's a pretty cool little vid, man. I really dug it. So hopefully we can make some content in the future. I need me go up there, or you come down here, or maybe while, you know, with the Iron Fly stuff going on, we can record a little bit there and put some stuff out there for that too.
That would be awesome. Hopefully I'll have a new camera by then, because this Nikon D750 I use is the best for video. But I'm thinking about getting a Sony mirrorless, probably a crop sensor mirrorless, like smaller sensor mirrorless. And hopefully that'll do a lot better on in terms of auto focusing and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm going to start doing a lot more video content. It is interesting. The editing process on it is definitely different. And it's a learning curve for me, but it is fun. If I can get the time to sit down and actually mess with it, and I'm learning a lot. There's a lot of YouTube usage on figuring out how to use Premiere Pro, but yeah, hopefully we'll be getting a lot more of that coming out soon.
Heck yeah, man. But yep. And as always, everybody, if you would like to reach out to us, ask us questions, drop some comments, things you like, things you don't like, things you think we could do to improve, or things we're doing good. Whatever the case is, we'd appreciate any feedback, any kind of engagement you guys have to offer. Hit us up on our socials and, you know, we'll try our best to respond and communicate with you guys. And thank you all for listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
Yep, we appreciate y'all listening. Don't forget to tag us in y'all's adventures. We'd love to see them.
Yep.
We'll catch y'all next time.
Peace.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.